Do you toss old cooking grease down the drain? Well, beware. You may be feeding a fatberg.
Fatberg is literally a mountain of fat that accumulates in a sewer and eventually blocks the sewer.
Find out what else scientists discovered in that greasy conglomerated mess.
Plus, ideas for salvaging, not scrapping, what you toss. Because we can hear the earth groaning.
The earth is not capable of infinitely creating the resources to make smartphones forever.
He's fighting for your right to repair your own electronics.
Meanwhile, stories of rebirth from the global garage sale.
China is the world's largest manufacturer of everything. So as a result, it's going to be the largest buyer of raw materials. And that's what recycling is.
It's Waste Not, next.
On Big Picture Science. Morning routine. I go into the kitchen and I burn my toast because that's how I like it.
Okay, my favorite bread, sourdough, just put in the pan. Second slice there and toaster oven on toast.
Then, about 3 minutes later,
and set off the smoke alarms. I mean, that is dark, dark, dark.
But not as dark as my visage when one morning I came down to find the thing didn't work. My toaster oven was on the fritz. So what did I do? Well, I fixed it. You'll find out how later. But what didn't I do? Replace it. I rebelled against our throwaway culture. I'm Seth Shostak, and this is Big Picture Science produced at the SETI Institute. In this episode, well, the Earth doesn't need more landfill, but a lot of people are working to dispose of our disposable culture, whether they're the global junk collectors who've created a billion-dollar industry around reuse, or consumer advocates who are lobbying for your right to repair your own electronics. Now, you may not know that many companies intentionally try to make it difficult to fix their stuff. This episode, Waste Not.
I'm Molly Bentley. Let's start with waste. In order to deep fry, you want the oil to be really hot. Now, this is going to generate a lot of grease. So the question is, what do you do with old grease? Well, what I do, I pour it into a cup here, let it cool, put it in the freezer, and then throw it in the trash. Although it also works in compost.
But let me tell you a cautionary tale, a horror genre tale, about what happens to those who toss cooking waste down the drain. Unbeknownst to the residents of Sidmouth, a coastal town in England, there was something hideous lurking beneath their feet. It was silently growing thanks to the waste fed into it from drains and toilets, a foul and glistening mass of gunk accumulating in the sewer. Sure, it was gross, but it wasn't the way it looked that sent city workers and scientists reeling.
The smell is absolutely awful. It's very, very organic. And when we took the samples back to our laboratory, you've never seen a laboratory empty so quickly as when we opened those buckets.
The buckets held samples of the town's first fatberg.
Berg means mountain. And a fatberg is literally a mountain of fat that accumulates in a sewer and eventually blocks the sewer so that operatives from the water company have to go down and clean it away.
I'm Julian Siddle. I'm a radio producer with the BBC.
A fatberg has been discovered in the sewers of Sidmouth, England. Julian, as a resident of the UK, what is your reaction to this?
How bizarre. I mean, Sidmouth is not exactly a big place. It's kind of a small town, you know, a kind of place where people go on holiday. I imagine that they have a kind of sewerage system, which is, you know, probably at least 100 years old and probably discharges into the sea in some way, you know. But, I mean, I'd heard of these things before. The one found in London produced a huge social media hit. It was filmed on the television, and, I mean, this thing was enormous. You know, imagine that at least the height of a couple of people, if you imagine one person standing on top of an on the shoulders of another one down in some huge kind of Victorian sewer, you know, from like a century ago or more, and they kind of broke it open, and there were, you know, all these horrible things in it, including loads of worms. Disgusting.
Fatberg worms came out?
Yes, they did. I expect it was delicious.
I mean, the Fatberg was delicious for the worms.
Yes, exactly.
Lovely Sidmouth was the newest member of the Fatberg Club, joined veteran members New York and London, whose enormous masses of sewer gunk first demonstrated that what is out of sight is not out of sight for long.
I'm Professor John Love, and I'm a synthetic biologist at the University of Exeter in England. This Fatberg actually measured something like 30 meters long, that's about 90 feet. And they needed about 1,000 trucks to get rid of it. It only took 5 years for that amount of fat to accumulate in the sewer.
But it requires more than just solidified fat to create something that was, well, bigger than a blue whale, as Dr. Love's team discovered when they conducted a Fatberg autopsy.
The actual Fatberg, though, the accretion of fat is helped by the fact that in the Fatberg, you get a lot of things like wet wipes, and things like that, that the fat sticks to, and therefore it doesn't actually flow properly to the wastewater treatment plant. And you get a positive feedback, a runaway accretion, if you like, of fat and wet wipes, things that should not be in the sewer, that are nonetheless thrown into the sewer by people. And then that itself also stops things like sand and grit from normally vacating the sewer as it normally would, and eventually just blocks the entire pipe, causing a massive tailback of sewerage up into the town. And at that point, obviously, the water company has to get involved to clean this up.
Now, how do you get this stuff out of the sewer? I mean, when these operatives go in, mm-hmm. presumably they're wearing maybe something like scuba diving gear.
The environment is terrible. It's like being in the worst Dungeons & Dragons episode you could ever think. It's a tiny, narrow tube full of fat. There is no oxygen. The operatives have to wear protective clothing. They also have to wear wetsuits and hazmat suits on top of each other so that they don't get contaminated by anything that might be in the Fatberg. They're also having to carry their own oxygen supply because there is absolutely no oxygen down there in that sewer. And they've got lances where they have pressure water, and they will basically just power pressure water the Fatberg to smithereens. Then they go in with big suction hoses and they suck up all that slurry, and then they carry on up the Fatberg until it's eventually all cleared. We were very, very interested also to discover whether or not this Fatberg would be a reservoir for human pathogens like bacteria or something like that. So we investigated those using sequencing. So we took a sample of fat. We extracted the DNA in that fat, and we found that actually the DNA from the bacteria that were contained in the fat was no different from the bacteria that you would find in a normal sewer. So it did not seem to pose an enhanced threat to health.
Just out of curiosity mm-hmm. there, John, what is the most bizarre thing you've ever pulled out of a Fatberg? I've got to say, years and years ago, one of my college roommates maintained that there were alligators in the sewers of New York.
Right.
Now, this is apparently a very, very common story, but the question was, is it true? And at some point, I called up the New York City Sewer Department, and I said, you ever find any alligators down there? He said, no. He said, however, we did find a dead horse, and we found plenty of shopping carts.
Right.
And I'm thinking, how do either of those get into the sewer?
Yeah.
So you're not finding big stuff.
No. The most interesting thing we found was a set of false teeth. But mostly everything else that we did find were sanitary products and wet wipes.
Now, you know, people have been throwing stuff away, and in particular into the toilet or the sink or whatever. I mean, they've been doing that ever since we've had indoor plumbing.
Yes.
Right? And so why is it that fatbergs are a contemporary phenomenon? Or is it just that, you know, that one of them finally got big enough? Or is it the crooked passages of Victorian-era sewage, sewers? Why now?
Well, you're kind of on the money there with the Victorian sewer idea. These sewers are actually hundreds of years old, and they were not built to essentially take away the waste for such a growing population. The southwest of England is an area of population growth, so the sewers are actually inadequate for that. But also, when these were designed, people were not throwing plastic-based wastes down the toilet. But the plastics that we find in wet wipes, and obviously in the plastic liners of, say, sanitary products or incontinence pads, we found a lot of those, actually, which might be because of the age of the population living in that area. But the thing is that these big plastic sheets just do not biodegrade and will eventually pollute the environment anyway. So it's not something that you really should be doing. You alluded earlier to the fat itself, and we analysed that fat and found that it was mainly beef or mutton tallow, which is consistent with Sunday roasts, if you like, in the UK. So people were just basically, you know, grilling their food and then putting the residual fat down the sink. And you don't need very much for it to accumulate because it forms little globules as it cools. And then eventually it's quite sticky as well. And so it will stick to rough parts of the brickwork in the sewer. A wet wipe will come along, stick to the fat. Then you'll get that positive feedback loop of accretion. And essentially what a fatberg is, it's a fascinating ecosystem, if you like, of a composite material. So fibers embedded in a matrix, and this time the matrix is fat itself. But we were able to identify the source of the fat as coming from, well, basically people's kitchens, and we were able to identify the solid parts of the fat that were coming from people's toilets. And they started a campaign now to educate people to try, rather than throwing fat down the sink, the thing to do is to basically either put it in the garden if you have one, where it will degrade very, very quickly and nourish your soil, or you just wipe it and put it in the bin. And I think that's the idea that they're trying to promote here.
But you did refer to this as an ecosystem.
Yeah.
And of course, that sounds like there's something alive down there. But on the other hand, you said there's absolutely no oxygen.
Yes.
So are these microbes that live, you know, on something other than oxygen? Are they methanogens? Or
yes, they are. So that's exactly what they are. They are methanogens. They're metabolizing extremely slowly, though. That's why the fat doesn't degrade very quickly. And when the water company took the fat away, the slurry that I was mentioning about earlier, they took that to a bioenergy plant, and they basically made methane from that fat.
So it could power my car.
It could do, yeah, if your car runs on methane.
Well, it might in the future.
Yes.
I mean, the idea of fatberg powered, I mean, I can see that as a bumper sticker.
Why not?
Finally, then, John, let me ask you. I presume, I mean, these fatbergs we've been talking about are there in the UK, but of course the UK is no fatter than other places, and particularly undoubtedly not as fat as America. So I presume there are fatbergs lurking below cities here as well, right?
Yeah, I would guess so. I don't know for sure. It might be that the sewers in America, being much more recent, are a lot larger and therefore maybe more able to take away, you know, maybe the flow through the sewer is faster. But I would guess that somewhere there are fatbergs lurking, yeah.
Maybe I have to coat all the inner walls of the sewers with Teflon or something. John Love, I want to thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
John Love is a synthetic biologist at the University of Exeter in England.
Well, clearly you don't think much about this when you pour that grease down the drain, as I used to do. I try not to do it anymore, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Well, you know, it's just a little bit of grease. And I go, come on. You know, it's grease. It'll just slide right through.
That's right. Well, now we know a little bit of grease becomes a whole lot of grease.
Yeah.
Even if you could toss it into the sewers, why do that if you could turn that grease into fuel, as he suggested? There may be many creative things that you can do with grease other than dispose of it.
Well, it's true, although for households it's probably not so practical. But restaurants certainly have been doing that.
As we fill our sewers with fat, our oceans with plastic, and our landfills with old laptops, people are thinking about new ways to use our resources and our goods. Coming up, stories from the global secondhand trade.
China is the world's largest manufacturer of everything. So as a result, it's going to be the largest buyer of raw materials. And that's what recycling is.
You might want to give your old jeans their own passport before you toss them out anyway, because after you say goodbye, they may embark on a trip around the world. It's Waste Not on Big Picture Science. Of course, it's not just grease and wet wipes that we toss without a thought. We live in a disposable culture, so some trash goes to recycling centers, compost sites, even waste-to-energy plants. But the majority of waste in the U.S. goes to the dump. And wherever it goes, it's a lot. For example, the largest city in the U.S. generates more than 14 million tons of trash every year.
You don't get to be a city of 8 million people without producing a little waste. And here we have a whole line of garbage bags. I suppose every day is garbage pickup here in New York City. Wait, what is this? It's the fold-out part of a bed from a couch. Okay, that's thrown in there. I don't know if that can be recycled. Thrown on top of these garbage bags here. And let's count. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20. Okay, there's about 30 garbage bags right there. Somebody already going through the garbage, pulling out all the bottles before the recycling truck comes. And you go around the corner here, and what is this? Two chairs. One is an office chair that's covered. One is a wooden chair. Oh my gosh. A metal chair that has a kind of mesh backing. This is really a moment of charity if anyone would step in. An old table, a lampshade, buckets of who knows what, and two pieces of luggage thrown in an enormous pile here. Glass table, too. Ironically, had author Adam Minter's great-grandfather come to New York, as many immigrants did in his time, he and his great-grandson might never have gotten into the junk trade.
My great-grandfather, when he came to the United States, he wanted to be in vaudeville, but he made the mistake of getting on a boat to Galveston, Texas. So when he got there, no education, no skills, didn't know anybody. So he did what you do when you don't have any education and you need to make some money. He started picking up rags from the streets of Galveston, Texas.
That slowly became his family's recycling business that moved up to Minneapolis. Journalist Adam Minter is the author of Junkyard Planet and recently Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale.
And in a sense, what I've done for the last few decades is basically trace people like my great-grandfather, only I've gone to Ghana, and I've gone to Tokyo, and I've gone to China, and I spent years living in China, meeting people who do these kinds of activities, and oftentimes building them up into multi-billion dollar businesses.
We're talking in this episode, well, we're talking trash, and specifically about alternatives to ditching it in a landfill. Now, when you recycle, yeah, you feel good, you feel virtuous. But recycling is more than just about ecology. It's also about economy. It has real economic benefits. We're going to find out in a moment why China is keen to get its hands on used Christmas lights. And speaking of China, while some of the trash that Molly saw on the streets of the Big Apple will be sorted and resold as raw material domestically, much of the rest that is recycle-worthy will be exported to India or China. Adam Minter says that his research indicates that the junk biz is the second biggest employer on the planet after agriculture.
All you need to do is go to an emerging market economy. Ideally, you go to Africa and you walk down the streets of, say, a place like Accra, Ghana or Nairobi, Kenya, and well over half of the stuff selling in stores is going to be secondhand. It's what we'd consider junk. But the retail economy, especially on the African continent, is primarily a secondhand economy. And we don't see that because it's oftentimes the stuff that we in developed economies throw out, whether it be Japan, the United States, Canada, or somewhere in Europe. So that's the scale of it. Think of an entire continent where most of their stuff is secondhand from somewhere else.
Now, you mentioned that your great-grandfather was a rag picker or whatever,
yeah.
Right? Picking up rags. Now, I don't know if there's a – I don't have a separate recycle bin for rags anymore. Mm-hmm. But are these organizations that do this recycling, I assume they're specialized. They don't just take everything that we throw out. They take, well, maybe the furniture or they take some other, you know, electronics or something mm-hmm. like that, right?
It's a very specialized industry. Let's talk about rags. I mean, it's a great example. You know, we don't see the rag picker anymore, but roughly one-third of the used clothes that are generated every year in the United States are turned into rags, literally cut up in rag-making factories both in the United States and abroad, and those rags are used by everyone and from everything from hotels to painters to oil and gas companies to wipe down their pipelines if there's leaks. It's an extraordinary industry and it's kind of hidden. We don't think of that as waste, but it's an extraordinarily important part of our economy.
You know, when I think of recycling waste, I think of, you know, big ships with containers filled with something
mm-hmm.
all headed for China. Why does so much trash seem to go to China?
Well, you know, what I always tell people is when you think about recycling, recycling doesn't exist without manufacturing. If somebody doesn't want to make something out of that recycled can, you know, you think of it as a recycled can when you put it in a bin. But if nobody wants to buy it and use it to make it into something else, it doesn't get used. China is the world's largest manufacturer of everything. So as a result, it's going to be the largest buyer of raw materials. And that's what recycling is. Whether it's newspaper, cardboard, plastic bottles, aluminum, automobiles, whatever it is, they are going to be the world's leading buyer. And so if you want to understand where recycling goes, you just have to follow the manufacturing.
What are the big items? I mean, is it electronics? Is it the rags? What are the major players in the recycling biz?
Well, by volume, by weight, the biggest commodity, if you will, is steel. And the biggest source of steel, the most recycled product in the world, is the American automobile. You know, we don't think of putting automobiles in a recycling bin because we don't. But they are recycled in specialized factories, and that steel gets recycled into new steel. So in the United States, roughly half the steel that's used in new products comes from secondary sources, means from recycling. So that's, by volume, the really big one. Paper and cardboard is also huge, and there's sort of a cycle. A recycler in California can send their recycling, their cardboard, to southern China, where that cardboard could be made into a new box for Nike shoes. Or they can send it to Vietnam, because Vietnam makes a lot of shoes now. And the cardboard from California, which might have come from Nike shoes, gets recycled into a new Nike shoe box and sent back to California. Somebody buys that box and those shoes, puts it in the recycling bin, and it goes back to Vietnam or China and made into a cardboard box for Nike shoes again.
You also talk about recycling Christmas tree lights.
Yes.
I mean, Christmas tree lights. I'm trying to wonder why people throw away Christmas tree lights, but I mean, the old ones used to have burned out bulbs or maybe a wire breaks or something like that. I mean, What do they do with recycled Christmas tree lights?
Well, it's essentially a disposable product. And what you do, it's a very clever system that they've developed throughout, actually, Asia. They used to take a can of gasoline, pour it on the Christmas tree lights, and set them on fire, and then you'd have leftover copper. But that's really bad for the environment. You don't want to do that anymore. And so in most places, they aren't. I've seen it done. But so what's done now is they basically shred them, and they build these small shredders with spinning blades that cut them up into tiny, tiny pieces. Then they mix them with water and put them on shaker tables. And the tables are tilted in one direction. It's a little bit like panning for gold. And as the water flows over, the heavier stuff, the copper, which is a very desirable commodity, stays in one place, and the plastic and the glass flows in another. And if you do that a couple times on these mechanized tables, you get some pretty clean commodities. And more often than not, the copper, at least, is recycled into Christmas tree lights. And they go right back to where they came from.
The endless Christmas tree light. The copper, well, what fraction of the copper that China uses actually comes from this kind of recycling? I mean, is it significant, or is it 1 or 2%?
No. I mean, it's hard to get really good numbers, but it's at least half. It's an extraordinarily high percentage of the copper in China. And, you know, until quite recently, when China put some restrictions on imports, more than half of that half was coming from imported sources because they didn't have enough of their own.
Well, can you give me any idea? I mean, suppose we shut that all down. I mean, not that that's possible, but suppose we just said from beginning tomorrow, no more recycling. You know, you don't need to sort your trash anymore. And we're not going to ship any of it overseas. And we're not going to take it to the scrapyard and have it chopped up or anything like that. Yeah, what would happen? What would be the scenario in the country 10 years from now?
Sure. Well, I'll talk to you from both ends. One, you would have a lot more material flowing into landfills. That's where it would go. And you would have a lot more material flowing into incinerators. So that will have some kind of environmental impact. But the more profound impact, in a way, will be what it does to manufacturing and the American economy. Because the American economy is very dependent upon recycled sources of raw materials. Amazon, for example, you know, tries to make its boxes from a significant amount of recycled content. All of a sudden, they're not going to be able to do that anymore. It's because it's all flowing into a landfill. So what are they going to do? They're going to be buying virgin paper, and all of a sudden, you're going to see forests in the southeastern United States being logged much more intensively than they are right now. Same with automobiles. You know, right now, roughly half of the steel that is used in the United States, including in automobiles, comes from recycled sources. Well, if you're not able to recycle that steel anymore, you're going to be digging more taconite mines, say, in northern Minnesota. I mean, northern Minnesota is a really pretty place. I've spent a lot of time up there. I'd hate to see more gaping gashes in the landscape of that area.
So you actually seek out junkyards when you travel. How does your wife feel about that? Is she also from a similar background?
No, my wife is not from that background, and I had to take her to junkyards and show her why these are such wonderful places. And it's sort of grown on her. I mean, if we're on vacation, I tell her there's a great scrapyard around here, and I bet they'd let us in to see their giant auto shredder. I still will get a skeptical look. But, you know, I've taken her to auto shredders, and she really likes them, and she gets the idea. This is this marvelous hidden business that affects all of us, impacts all of us. It has amazing technologies and equipment that go into it, and amazing levels of knowledge that you wouldn't even think there's this kind of knowledge base out there. So it's a lot of fun.
I have to ask you about an auto shredder. I mean, I've seen auto crushers. Mm. They put the car into this thing and, yeah, you know, all this, these hydraulics, whatever, and they crush it down to the thickness of a waffle or something like
right.
that. But what is a shredder? I mean, how does a shredder work?
A shredder is just what it sounds like. These are sometimes as much as 10,000 horsepower machines, and what they have inside are these large hammers, usually about 2 to 3 dozen of these hammers spinning around, each weighing, I think, close to 500 pounds, and you slowly feed a car into the shredder, and those hammers pulverize it so that you get basically fist-sized chunks of metal and whatever else is in there. So it goes in a car, you see a lot of steam come out, and what comes out is very hot chunks of steel and aluminum and copper, and there's bits of course, seat and everything else in there, depending on what was pulled out before it went through the shredder. And that's generally how cars are recycled and have been recycled since the 1960s, early 1970s in the United States and around the world.
So then you can vacuum it into a truck or a railroad hopper car and away
yeah.
it goes.
Yeah, and steel mills love it. That shredded steel is a commodity. There's a price every day. You can go and get the market price for shredded automobile steel. And it's a coveted raw material in steel mills.
I'm going to look up shredded automobile futures for my...
There's lots of great videos on YouTube of car shredders. You'll enjoy them.
Okay. All right. Well, what about my electronic stuff? What about my computers, you know, the consumer electronics and so forth? You know, they come out with a new model, and while there's nothing really wrong with the old model,
right,
there's a tendency to toss it out. Where do they go?
Right. Well, that's the thing. You know, just because you don't want that three-year-old computer anymore, you're ready to upgrade, doesn't mean that there isn't somebody somewhere who doesn't want. I mean, and so oftentimes and increasingly, there's a secondhand market for electronics in the United States. But if there isn't a market in the United States, there is a market in emerging market nations for this technology. And that was one of the most enjoyable parts of doing this book, was going to places like Ghana and seeing how technology that we don't think about anymore, you know, we upgraded out of it 5 years ago, is still going strong. There was a gentleman by the name of Ibrahim Al-Hassan in Savalugu, northern Ghana, who I came across, and he was working on 45, 50-year-old tube televisions for his neighbors and making a living from it. That's how they would get their entertainment and you know.
Well, where does he get the tubes?
Well, right. Well, the amazing thing about CRTs, the cathode ray tubes.
Oh, those kind of tubes. Okay.
Yeah. The cathode ray tube televisions and monitors, is they last forever, essentially. You know, they don't wear out. And so if the tube is intact, he can fix the electronics on it. And I'll never forget, he was working on a Sony Trinitron that did not have remote control. You had to actually manually change the channel. And he's an incredibly skilled man. He had found the parts to turn it into a remote controlled television.
Well, finally, Adam, I mean, you know, this is kind of an upbeat story you're telling here. And if people are making good money out of our discarded waste, maybe we shouldn't feel so bad about our throwaway culture.
Well, we should feel bad in one sense, and that is that we still generate far more stuff than can, you know, be purchased for reuse or recycling. It's one thing to be putting stuff into your recycling bin. There's going to be a demand for that from manufacturers. But where things get tricky is when you're talking about, say, IKEA furniture. There's a lot of IKEA furniture out there, and it's essentially single-use furniture. If you've ever bought an IKEA shelf and put it in the back of a pickup and tried to move it, by the time you get it to where it's supposed to go, it's fallen apart. It's just not very well made. And that's the kind of stuff that's really a problem. And it sort of is the dark side of this story of recycling, because there's just so much that cannot be recycled. Fast fashion, which we've all heard about, you know, labels like Forever 21, which are making garments that can only be washed maybe 1 to 5 times before they just start falling apart. Not much can be done with that sort of thing from a recycling standpoint. So, you know, what I always tell people is, by all means, consume. That's the culture we live in. But when you buy stuff, think about stuff that maybe has a second life. That's something that maybe after you're done using it, it's durable enough where you can see passing it along to somebody else. I mean, and that's sort of one step in sort of fixing this problem of so much stuff coming into the waste markets that simply is waste. It can't be reused and recycled.
Recycle and repair.
Right.
Adam Minter, thanks so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll recycle this interview.
Adam Minter is the author of Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale.
Adam Minter can talk about real firsthand experience, at least of his relatives, of this whole recycling business. And the thing that struck me, Molly, was that it's not a 1% or 2% effect. This is a lot of recycled material. It's really important. It's half the copper in China and more than half the steel in the U.S. and whatever.
I was also interested in the ingenuity that Adam Minter discussed of some of these entrepreneurs. So if they don't have a part, they look for a part somewhere else and they salvage that and then bring it back to the television that they're fixing, and they make a television that works. So it's entrepreneurial, but it also shows some creativity.
I recommend you go on YouTube and look at how all these guys in India are taking ordinary stuff and turning it into very sophisticated stuff with basically hand tools. It's remarkable.
Wait, don't toss that laptop. Save yourself hundreds of dollars and the earth from yet one more hunk of toxic waste. Why don't you try fixing it instead?
We need to really be thinking differently about our relationship with electronics. We need to make stuff last a lot longer, and that relationship with electronics is empowered and made possible by providing people with the ability to repair and maintain on their own terms.
The Right to Repair movement is fighting for your right to fix your own electronics. Next.
It's Waste Not on Big Picture Science. And by the way, if you have thoughts about this show or other episodes that you'd like to share, you can connect with us on social media. We're on Twitter @BiPiSci. In a moment, you'll hear about the pushback against companies that intentionally foil your attempts to repair your devices. But first, do you find old circuit boards beautiful? At a recent science conference, Molly spotted a booth where bright green and vivid blue earrings and necklaces were attracting admirers.
My name is Amanda Presky, and I own a company called Circuit Breaker Labs.
This is not usually how I see circuit breakers laid out like this. Can you describe what it is that you're doing with these circuit breakers?
It's all transformed into jewelry. So I use a combination of materials, including broken electronics, circuit boards, and epoxy resin to create a finished jewelry piece.
Could you describe it for us, what it is that you've done here? Invoke your best descriptive powers.
So imagine like a subway map or a cityscape or just an arrangement of sort of three-dimensional boxes and lines. That's what a circuit board looks like at its very basic description. And then add on a layer of color, because the solder mask, which is the top protective layer that helps in soldering the board without creating short circuits, it comes in a wide range of colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, black, white. There are a lot of options there. So when you combine these textures with these colors, it looks very futuristic and kind of just techie.
It does, and we don't often get to see circuit boards. And when you look at them, it looks almost like you're looking down an aerial view of a city.
Yes, that's the comment I get a lot, and also what I see a lot when I'm trying to figure out which part of the circuit board I'm going to use to make into jewelry, because not every part is interesting.
And we should say that Amanda's just using part of the circuit board, not the entire circuit board. So these really are wearable. You're doing an excellent job, too, of multitasking, because I'm asking you about your jewelry while you're selling some of your jewelry. Dave White, you're from Arizona State University. I see on your badge, I see that you are now purchasing some of this jewelry. Can you tell us what drew you to it?
My wife is a professor as well, and my daughter is a budding scientist. And so I think it's a really neat combination of pretty jewelry that's inspired by science.
Isn't it interesting that computers dominate our lives, and now it's come to the point where we're also going to wear them?
Yeah, I like the physical, tactile idea of seeing the circuit within the jewelry.
Amanda, what made you decide to turn... First of all, you're a computer scientist.
Actually, I'm a chemist. I have a PhD in semiconductor nanocrystal synthesis.
So how did you get into the art and the science of creating jewelry from circuit boards?
So when I was a kid, I got into making of all varieties, and I just fell in love with jewelry. It's small, and it communicates your personality in a nonverbal way, and as a shy kid, that was perfect for me. And when I was in college, my brother had a broken circuit board, and he didn't know what to do with it, so he basically challenged me to turn it into art of some variety. And since jewelry was my favorite medium, I made jewelry.
Amanda, thank you so much for talking to us about your circuit board jewelry.
Thanks so much for having me.
Amanda Presky is a chemist and the owner of Circuit Breaker Labs, where she turns discarded printed circuit boards into precious wearables. You know, I wonder if she can make something for me to wear on the lecture circuit.
We are talking in this episode about efforts to change our disposable culture. And when it comes to big offenders, nothing beats electronic waste. The UN says that e-waste is now the fastest growing category of waste in the world. Consumers buy and toss at a furious rate, creating tens of millions of tons a year of discarded televisions, laptops, and phones. Most end up in landfills, where toxic metals leach into the environment.
Okay, this is just crazy. I mean, when I was growing up, just about the time that paper was patented, I mean, I didn't chuck broken electronic devices. I always tried to fix them. When my family got its first television, it came with a schematic, you know, a diagram that showed how it was wired up. And so you could go in and repair it. You could replace dead tubes. You could replace dead anything.
Companies today are making that hard to do. Now, maybe you are like Seth and your phone, your television, even your tractor breaks and you want to fix it. And then you discover that the company won't provide the parts or the instruction you need to do it yourself. Well, don't toss that object just yet, because consumer advocates are coming to your rescue. Nathan Proctor is the National Campaign Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or PIRGS, Right to Repair Campaign. And Kyle Weens is the CEO of iFixit, an internet repair community. Together, they imagine a world where we reuse, salvage, and rebuild. And they are lobbying to have a right to repair law passed so that companies will provide the five things that you need to repair your electronics.
The manuals, the schematics, the information, whatever software is needed to repair that device. Any spare parts that are available to the dealership should be available to us, as well as any kind of special tools needed for repair.
Okay, so again, those five things, the manuals, the schematics, like the one that came with our first television, the necessary software, spare parts, and any special tools you really need. But honestly, I mean, even with that, can anyone really repair something like an iPad? It's a very sophisticated device. My toaster oven went on the fritz the other day. I unscrewed the back cover and I was able to fix it. But my toaster oven is far less complex than any iPad or phone. So, Kyle, isn't this just increasing complexity a natural progression of consumer products?
It's actually, I would say, easier to fix an iPhone than it was a TV back in the day, if you have the information and you know how to do it. Most repairs are just part swapping. You need to put in the battery, you take it apart, you put the new battery in, put it back together. It's straightforward. What is different is that schematic that used to be included. In the early 90s, the TV companies stopped including those schematics. And what we have discovered is that the kind of perception that things aren't fixable anymore is more driven by the manufacturer's intent than it is by unrepairable products. Most things out there, especially TVs, are very straightforward to fix.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit. You say they're very easy to fix. I mean, a battery is one thing. But if you're talking about the actual circuitry, I mean, you know, the circuitry used to be, whether it was tubes or transistors or integrated circuits, they used to be in sockets. You could remove a defective one and plug in another one. But everything now is, you know, one solid mass of integrated electronics. I mean, is that really easy to repair?
Well, sometimes it's as simple as swapping the board. So you don't have to, you know, change out an individual component. If you have a TV, most TVs that fail, it's like maybe the power board inside. And swapping out that power board is a heck of a lot more efficient than going and taking that entire TV and melting it down and then making a new TV in Asia and shipping it over to you. Much simpler to swap out maybe a 6-inch wide circuit board.
But how many people are likely to do that? I mean, you know, my next door neighbor's never going to do that, no matter how easy it is. I mean, is this a substantial fraction of the user base?
Well, if you think about it like home improvement projects. You know, how many of us go into Home Depot on a regular basis? Maybe it's like 1 in 5 people are regularly doing home improvement projects, but houses are not disposable, right? If your toilet breaks, you're going to hire someone to get it fixed or fix it yourself. You have that option. And the DIY ethos and possibility, it drives some of the economics that make professional repair viable as well. So we need both. We need professional repairers that are out there fixing these things, and we need consumers to be able to fix them.
Nathan, I mean, does this extend beyond electronics? We've been talking about electronics. You know, I mean, if you're, I don't know, what Kyle just said, your toilet. If my toilet breaks, I do indeed try and fix it. It isn't very complicated. And that's true for a lot of the stuff in my house, you know, a fan or whatever. So, I mean, this right to repair, is it really relevant to a broad swath of the kinds of things I buy?
It is, and it is increasingly. So if you were to have an appliance, let's just say your refrigerator broke, we're seeing now that companies will design these products such that you need a manufacturer code to reset the fridge so it starts running again. And because all of these products now run software, and there's the ability to program that software to discourage repair, and that's exactly what we're seeing in everything from toasters to tractors.
So why are they doing that? I mean, the obvious answer is, well, they just want to sell you a new product. It's just greed, if you will, bottom line. But, you know, they might argue, no. I mean, if you get into that, you know, you're only going to make it worse. So what do you...
Right. If you were to ask that question to Apple, the answer that they have typically given is, we want our customers to have the best experience. And in order to facilitate that experience, we take away their options and their control and choice. So they believe, or they say, that they're trying to kind of control the user experience, but there's a huge cost to the consumer when they lose that control, when they cede that control to the manufacturer. And in the case of something like a lot of products, like a John Deere tractor, the repair business associated with maintaining those tractors is a very important revenue stream. There was an article in Crain's Chicago Business that found that John Deere dealership profit margins are 5 times higher on the repair of equipment than it is the sale of new equipment. So there's a huge incentive to force people to have to bring their equipment to the John Deere dealership or the Apple store or whatever the authorized repair facility is. And meanwhile, There's all these independent repair businesses which are being locked out.
To what extent is this just a consequence of the increasing sophistication of the products we buy? I mean, here in the Silicon Valley, there's something called Moore's Law. Every 2 years, your computer gets twice as fast and so forth. And on the one hand, you can say, oh, that's just planned obsolescence. They just want you to buy a new computer, and that's probably true. I mean, I don't know. But in any case, these computers themselves, if you open them up, are, you know, more and more difficult to do anything to other than plug them in. So at that end of the market, if you're talking about those kinds of products, of course they're going to move in the direction of being less and less amenable to repair. But there's, you know, the bulk of all the stuff you buy isn't. So is this really a problem?
I would say that that attitude is exactly what the manufacturers are cultivating in the consumer mindset. But I've talked to, I mean, let me give you an example of an advocate for right to repair in Michigan. Surya, who was in high school, broke his iPhone, was too embarrassed to tell his parents, so he went online, watched a YouTube video, and fixed it, and realized that it really wasn't that hard. Started fixing all of his friends' phones and had a little side hustle until his mom found a shoebox full of cash under his bed and thought that he had become a ne'er-do-well. I had to explain to her that he had a thriving impromptu repair business. So, I mean, people can fix this stuff. I think people need to kind of push back on that idea that nobody can fix anything, so we should stop trying because manufacturers are making stuff so complicated. I mean, I just talked to too many people who figured it out by themselves, and it turns out it wasn't all that difficult.
Yeah. Well, Kyle, look, you know, nobody's arguing that we need legislation to make it possible to fix your bicycle, for example. I mean, and, you know, anybody who wants to can fix their bike and probably always will be able to. I mean, it doesn't have surface mount electronics in it or anything like that. So what changes if the legislation you guys are talking about, and you should describe what you're talking about specifically, how would that change anybody's life?
Sure. Yeah, the real change is that there are now electronics and software involved in these things. And so the modern wrench, the modern equivalent of a wrench, may be a diagnostic software tool from the manufacturers. And so it's really their insistence on withholding that information that is what is driving this to the point where we need to pass a law. And it's a very focused, very small scale law. What it says is that if you're running a repair operation as a manufacturer, you need to make sure that independent repair shops and consumers have access to the same parts, tools, and information that you have. That's it.
So are you guys optimistic that you're going to see some legislation enacted, Kyle?
I think so. Things are moving very well. I mean, it is always going to be challenging to go up against the manufacturers on their home turf, right? They are accustomed to stopping all kinds of legislation, and they have very high-paid lobbyists defending their turf. But we had bills introduced in over 20 different states so far this year, and we are, you know, hearing very good things from inside a number of capitals.
All right. Well, finally, and I guess I'll begin with Nathan on this. I kind of wonder, I'm older now than I was. I suppose that obtains for a lot of people. But when I look at the, you know, young folks standing around at the gate at the airport or whatever, they're all looking at their phones and so forth. When I was a kid, you know, building stuff down in the basement was something that most of my friends did. Everybody was interested in that. People were hot rodding their cars, whatever. I don't see too much of that now. And I kind of wonder whether the mindset has changed, or is it still true that the maker movement, the do-it-yourself movement, is alive and well? I kind of wonder, Nathan, do young people still have an interest in how things work, taking them apart and fixing them?
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend that you go to a local fix-it clinic or community repair event. I know that in California, there's actually a number of these events where most of the electronics fixing is done by high schoolers who just think it's a really interesting and fun thing to do. So they fix stuff for free for their neighbors. The ability to tinker and to fix and to find out about how stuff works is a really important part about inspiring people to pursue careers in technology, engineering, and science. And I do think that we need to kind of rethink the way our society treats stuff in general.
Kyle?
Absolutely. We are really, I think, on the cusp of shifting things back. You know, we have over 10 million people on iFixit every month learning how to repair things. In the last year, 1 in 5 Californians got on iFixit to learn how to fix something that they owned. You know, with your toaster oven, it's possible. There's something called a thermal fuse that is a single-time trip device. So it's possible you overheated your your toaster oven once. All you got to do is get in there, cut that off, wire a new one on, and it'll be good as new.
That's exactly what I did. It cost me 10 cents in parts and, an hour and a half of time. but was better than $300.
So if your hair dryer stops working, if a curling iron stops working, if it's a rice cooker or a toaster, right, any of these things that heat up, almost always it's the thermal fuse. It's that 10-cent part that goes out. And it's absolutely crazy to go and buy a new one instead of just fixing the one that you have.
All right. Well, Kyle Weens, thanks so very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And Nathan Proctor, thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Nathan Proctor is the National Campaign Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, PIRG's Right to Repair Campaign. And Kyle Weens is the CEO of iFixit, an internet repair community. And together they are giving me the confidence to try repairing devices myself.
Yeah, well, there's that. But also, all those guys, the corner repair shops, you used to find them on every corner. They need this stuff, too. So even if you're not going to fix it, maybe you want your next-door neighbor to open a shop and fix things.
Well, the big picture in this show, then, is that we live in a toss-away culture. And I wonder if a lot of that is because once stuff is out of sight, whether you're throwing fat down the drain or you're throwing away your electronics, whatever it may be, we don't have to face our waste. And because we're not encouraged to reuse or rebuild it, we're actually perfectly content with that. But with the right motivation, we can extend the life of objects and tread more softly on the earth.
Yeah, I think this is something new. You know, when the Industrial Revolution really got underway, suddenly people could get these kinds of products, better stoves for the kitchen, an electric refrigerator. I mean, there were all these things. But it wasn't the expectation that you would have to replace them quickly. And that is different now.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with this Right to Repair campaign. And if indeed Nathan Proctor and Kyle Weens and their associates pass these laws so that companies have to turn over what you need to be able to repair your electronics, that would be progressive.
And let me tell you something else in that regard, because when I fixed my toaster oven, I first went online. There were six YouTube videos about how to fix that toaster oven.
How's your toaster oven working now?
Perfect, just perfect. I mean, that toast is indistinguishable from a black velveteen.
And that really is how you like it, just burn.
It is. Yeah, it's probably not good for me, but yes.
Well, thank you to those who help us salvage this show and do so every week. Senior producer Gary Niederhoff, assistant producer Sarah Derwin, and operations manager Barbara Vance. I am executive producer Molly Bentley.
And thanks also to financial support from Rena Scholsky David and Sammy David and the William K. Bowes Jr. Foundation. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization whose scientists study the origin and nature of life. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak, and I do my best to fix everything but a horse race. Also, a big thanks to our listeners.
Okay, what else are in these bags? I don't want to be too nosy, but I am curious. Okay, that looks like some kind of plastic bodysuit. Maybe that's not what that is. It's just what it looks like. I'm not going to dig around. Let's not look in that. I'm not going to look in any of these, actually.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
And now, medical myths and facts with Dr. Richard Curtis.
Most of us assume that memory loss is an inevitable part of aging. We picture the brain slowly wearing down, cells dying, connections weakening, and thinking becoming slower. But scientists have discovered something fascinating. A small group of older adults called superagers. These are people in their 80s whose memory performs as well as someone 20 or 30 years younger. A new study published in Nature suggests one reason why. The answer may lie in whether the aging brain can still make new brain cells. For many years, neuroscientists believed that once adulthood began, the brain stopped producing neurons, You were born with what you had, and that was it. But more recent research suggests that at least one part of the brain may continue to generate new neurons throughout life. That region is called the hippocampus, a small structure deep in the brain that is essential for forming new memories. In this study, in Nature, researchers examined donated brains from several groups of older adults, people with normal aging, people with mild memory problems, people with Alzheimer's disease, and super agers. They looked for signs of adult neurogenesis, the process by which new neurons are born and mature. The scientists searched for three stages of developing brain cells: stem cells, which are like newborns, neuroblasts, which are developing cells, and immature neurons, which are almost fully grown. What they found was striking. Superagers have roughly twice as many developing neurons in their hippocampus as typical older adults, and far more than people with Alzheimer's disease. In other words, part of their brain appeared to remain biologically young, still producing new cells that could support memory. Even more interesting, the new neurons in superagers showed genetic characteristics that seemed to protect them from the effects of aging. The Alzheimer's brains revealed another clue. They actually had many stem cells, but very few developing neurons. That suggests the brain still has the raw material to make new cells, but the process may be stalled. If scientists learn how to restart that process, it could open entirely new ways to treat memory loss. Now, this study won't settle the debate. Some neuroscientists still question how much neurogenesis really occurs in adult humans. But the findings point to an encouraging possibility. The aging brain may be far more plastic and adaptable than we once believed. And the lesson may be simple. Some brains age normally, some decline, but some seem to keep renewing themselves. Understanding why could be one of the most important clues to preserving memory as we grow older.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind-seniors.org.
You say you love a good book, that you enjoy listening to a good story that piques your interest, which challenges your imagination to explore places where it has never gone before? If so, then Audio Journal's Backyard Bookshelf is for you. Backyard Bookshelf is Audio Journal's award-winning book reading program that always has a local flavor, featuring books about New England, as well as books written by local authors or native New Englanders, be it fiction or nonfiction. So join us, won't you? Just tune in every Friday at 4 p.m. and enjoy. That's Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal.